All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
All right, should we start jizzing over at Emma Raducanu or what?
Yeah, that's definitely on the agenda for today.
Yeah.
All right, welcome to a new episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. Loads of stuff to talk about because in the last couple of weeks, we didn't actually do one last week because you was in, where were you? Penzance or something?
Penzance, whale watching and looking at St. Michael's Mount. It was fantastic. I managed to get a little 6-minute segment in from the Airbnb we were staying in, but nothing in depth last week. And I wanted to get the ball back rolling because it's always tempting to fucking let things slip after you have a little break.
It's reinvigorated me. I feel like kind of excited for today because I feel like there's so much that, you know, on the agenda. Obviously, we've got football stuff. We've got the US Open men's and women's finals to talk about. An NFL week one preview and then obviously the regular boxing stuff. So an action-packed kind of episode for today.
Now, the footy last night was outrageous, man. The Man City-Leipzig game was crazy. And Tino was like having heart attacks over the Blues against Fulham. So
he's got all that. He's got all that amazing football that you could have watched. Like Liverpool, AC Milan, 5-goal thriller. You got your Man City game, 9-goal thriller. And you got like PSG with their lineup. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to watch the Blues. Fair play, man. Yeah. You got to appreciate that.
7,000 sold out of the Blues.
7,000 sold out. Get in. All right. So we'll start off with the preamble ramble, which is... Arsene, we love you, but this World Cup every 2 years thing is not your greatest idea. So I think it needs to be left alone. What do you think, Jim?
I don't agree with you, you know, because how many England qualifiers are there or international qualifiers are there where it's just dead? For me, I'm not interested in those at all because I basically expect England to get to the tournament. I know like 2008 and we've had times where we haven't qualified for tournaments, but I'm not bothered about... Even in the new, like, what's it, the European League system that they try and make up, they tried to rehash it a few years ago, didn't they? I'm not bothered, man. I only get bothered about watching England when the tournaments come about. So every 2 years for me would be sound, but I don't know how they'd structure it. It'd be one every year, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So basically, you're saying, oh, you don't want to see England versus Andorra, England versus San Marino, England versus Malta. But
yeah,
but the thing is, if you want to see the World Cup finals like every 2 years, you're going to have more qualifiers, aren't you? Unless what you do is the weaker sides have to qualify first for it. In a way, you're making it sort of the World Cup, but then like an elitist tournament. So it's a bit like the Super League, isn't it? So it's basically the Super League for countries. And the thing is, if World Cup is every 2 years, what would happen to the Euros? Because they'd be at the same time in the Euros.
They'd be concurrent years, wouldn't they? So it'd be World Cup 1 year, Euros the next, World Cup. To be fair, now I'm thinking about it, probably wouldn't work, would it?
I don't think so, really. It'd be too much football. There's already so much football on. Anyway, these players are playing 60-game seasons as it is. And then, you know, add on, you know, the extra games they got to play for their countries. If you're doing that every single year, you're looking at like 70, 75 games that these players are playing in a season. And, you know, obviously no one feels sorry for footballers, especially ones at the elite stage because of how much money they get paid. But you think about it, they're already playing 9 months around the year. They don't really get much time off anyway. If you're doing international competitions every single year, you're looking at maybe they get 3 or 4 weeks off a year.
I'm starting to think my soft spot for Arsene Wenger has overridden my actual sense. I'm willing to admit that for the preamble.
Well, I think that Arsene Wenger's going at it from the perspective of he's trying to basically increase the quality of like the World Cup competition. So he's coming at it from a sort of spectatorial perspective. Whereas I think FIFA, we all know what FIFA are like. So they're coming at it from a purely commercial perspective, aren't they?
Yeah.
Like they're looking to increase revenue streams from the World Cup. So, and obviously that's how, countries like Qatar have managed to get World Cup, Russia, US and Mexico, with Donald Trump promising them something crazy like 1.6 billion in revenue streams or something. It might have even been more than that. So obviously there's a commercial and monetary incentive for FIFA to have this every 2 years. But I think Arsene Wenger was coming it from more of a footballing perspective. So that's the only kind of like saving grace for me, because obviously I respect Arsene and I think the way he's trying to progress the game and in his role with FIFA. But yeah, I don't think this is going to work. I don't think it will come through either.
But I don't think it would be too much football, because the Champions League finals are the biggest game in the world and it's once a year. I don't think the scheduling would work that well, like having it concurrently. But I don't think there is such a thing as too much football. People lap it up, man. You'd think it would be saturated by now, but People love it more than ever.
And that's one of the arguments. Would the quality and the sheen of the World Cup be diluted if we moved it from 4 years to 2 years? You know, would the sort of interest not be there as much?
Nah, people would still love it, man. I think people would get used to it. After the second one comes around, people would be like, oh, sick. We don't have to wait another 2 years for a World Cup. Back to the pub, lads, lads, lads. You know the score, man.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept, but I personally think it would definitely overshadow the Euros. You know, because they would have to shift, and obviously they'd have to work with it. So they almost they'd have to go every 2 years. Obviously, they would have to go in between, wouldn't they? So essentially, yeah, you're skipping out a year in between. So it's just more and more football. But as you say, you know, football is the most popular sport on the planet. It's a package that consumers like are constantly wanting all over the globe now. So, you know, potentially there's room for it. So we'll leave that there and we'll move on to the five things you might have missed. So number one, a German amateur football team. I don't know if you saw this, Jim. They took to the field last week, almost completely in the nude. The Nationalmannschaft, which is a pun on the German words for nude and national team, debuted in front of a 300-strong crowd in Duisburg, Germany. Now, this team consists of both men and women of all ages, and they are completely in the nude, apart from their socks and boots, but also have their shirt numbers painted on their bare backs. The artist responsible for organising the event, Gerrit Starzowski. He seems to have a penchant for this naked style of playing, as it's not his first endeavour. He had previously fielded a team in order to protest against the increasing commercialisation of professional football and has since called it a furious display of artistry for connoisseurs.
It's a nice little excuse to have people get their kit off. I think the Germans are into that as well. I can't remember if it's Edward Munch. I don't know if he's German, but he sounds pretty German from around that neck of the woods. And me and India went to watch an exhibition or visit an exhibition in Norway. Edward Munch is an artist. And it was all just like pictures of lads sticking things up their asses and that. And I was just thinking, this is really like fetishized. I don't know. I always associate like kinkiness with Germans, really. So this didn't really strike me as anything mad. But also as a concept, it's a good way to illustrate that, isn't it? Like we all wear branded things. We're all walking, talking billboards for massive companies and their messages and their profits. So it's a good way to try and dress that down.
Number two, sticking with football. So Erling Haaland is obviously pretty good. He's 21 years old and he has now scored more hat-tricks than Wayne Rooney, who got 10, Samuel Eto'o, who got 9, and Fernando Torres, who got 8. And he's now 11 goals off John Crew's record total of 23 international goals for Norway's all-time top goal scorer after his hat-trick last week against Gibraltar, which might have been 2 weeks ago now since the last time I wrote this. But yeah, what do you think of him?
I don't find it that surprising that he's going to beat John Carew's record. But having more hat-tricks than Rooney, Eto'o and Torres, that's pretty incredible, man. And he's only 21. I've said to you before, man, Haaland and Mbappe, I'm very slow to get on the hype train for this young lads because obviously now everything's the best thing ever. Oh, he's the greatest player since so-and-so and always broke this record. Like the hyper focus on stats can really lead you down the path of overestimating a player's ability. And I don't really want to fall into that trap. Obviously, he's a powerhouse, man. And when he decides to curl the ball on his left foot, like there's pretty much no stopping him. Do you know what I mean? I think it's all a bit quick and he's playing in a good side as well. So obviously, he's a good player. He's a top-level European striker. But let's see how he goes over the next two or three seasons. I don't want to call him a flash in the pan, but there's a difference between having a year and a half, 2 years of like good games and doing that over a decade, which is what those other players did. So we'll see. I think the jury's out, but I admit he's better than I was saying to you before. I was saying he's basically average in it, but he's not average. Though. He's much better than that for sure.
Yeah, quite clearly he's going to move on to bigger things. I don't think he'll stay for Dortmund for the foreseeable future. I think maybe, you know, two or three seasons you could see moving to the Premier League, perhaps to someone like Man City, Man United. He will get a big move to a big club. And then it will be like we're going to see what he's made of. If he manages to consistently perform at the way he has been for a big club, then he's really going to cement himself as one of the emerging sort of like great players. But yeah, as you say, he's got a long way to go, but to be scoring the goals the way he is at his age is just incredible. And obviously Dortmund, they're not a sort of top 10 side in the world, are they? You wouldn't really put them in the top 10 sides in the world at the minute. They'd probably just be outside of it. Do you know what I mean? In terms of their comparison to say Bayern Munich, I think they're a long way off Bayern Munich at the minute.
You know, I was just about to say, I can see him going to Bayern Munich, rather than coming to the Prem, because Lewandowski is like coming to the end, even though he's absolutely smashing it. He scored 18 goals consecutive games, so you can't really say he's done yet, but his time's coming to an end, and Haaland's the perfect replacement for him. So I can see him staying in the Bundesliga, really, and just stepping up to Bayern. Classic moves.
Yeah, and yeah, exactly. Like, Dortmund have basically been a feeder club for Bayern over the last sort of like 5 years. You know what I mean? They signed Upamecano. They signed Marcel Sabitzer. Their coach has gone there. You know, so there's been a lot of players. Yeah, yeah. There's been a lot of players that have moved, Götze, yeah, that moved from Dortmund over to Bayern Munich. So that would be probably the most sensible move for him. All right, so give us number three.
Apparently, Deontay Wilder said all of his daughter's potential boyfriends are going to have to spar 3 rounds with him so he can make sure they're going to be properly protected. And this reminded me of that scene in Bad Boys 2 where Reggie comes to the door and Will Smith's like pretending to drink from the cognac bottle. He's like, I've just got out of jail, I ain't going back. And I was thought to myself, like, that is just overprotectiveness, isn't it? Like, former heavyweight champ of the world, best KO ratio in history. These lads are not going 3 rounds with you. And I can imagine him tooling them up as well, just to prove a point. So you've just basically forced your daughters into having secret relationships. Good move, Deontay. Nice one.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not great parenting, is it really? But it is quite funny. Like, obviously, nobody's going to last like 30 seconds in it. Like, realistically, in the ring with Deontay Wilder, unless he's going to fight somebody that's a pro boxer that's going to try and take his daughter out for a few dates. But
imagine his daughter starts like sliding into Tyson Fury's DMs, man. Just
we might actually finally get the fight to happen.
Just to show him what's what. But another bit of news from last week for number four, man. So this is something that's come up on the podcast quite often in the past. And it was quite an unseemly thing to watch. So MMA fighter Alana McLaughlin won her debut fight by choking out Celine Provost in the second round last Friday. The reason we're bringing this up is because McLaughlin was not only born a man, but he also served 6 years in the US Special Forces and has a tour in Iraq under a belt as well. The commentators during the fight used this information and McLaughlin's admittedly tragic personal life to try and lubricate this fundamentally unfair contest. But that being said, the gender disparity, all that in play, Celine Provost was tooling her up when they were standing, but McLaughlin was clearly a student of the Homer Simpson school of fighting, and she was absorbing as much punishment as Provost could dish out before she tired. McLaughlin's strength won out in the end, though. She scored a shitty double leg takedown and a painfully slow transition to the back. She managed to lock in a rear naked choke for the win, but for me, there was nothing to celebrate here. I mean, her skills standing were so inferior to Provost. It was just basically that, just strength and determination, admittedly. You have to be brave to get into the cage, but she just bulldogged her down there. There was no disparity in skill. It was just strength and genetic superiority, really.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. If she would have won based on her sort of like technical ability and, you know, like stylistically, she dominated and she looked a lot better than that, you know, then you probably could have, you know, said, all right, fair enough. You know, she deserves to be in the ring. But she's won by pure strength, and we know where that strength is coming from. You know, we're not having the wall pulled over our eyes, is it? And, you know, obviously there's been, we spoke about the sort of the New Zealand weightlifter.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That was a lot different because, you know, I suppose she's going into a sport where it's purely dependent on your ability. Obviously, there's a lot of technique involved as well with the clean and jerk and stuff like that. But you're talking about the ability and her strength, like to basically like monitor her strength and use that strength. Whereas I think fighting there's a lot of different facets that go into it, isn't it? So, you know, but she's obviously dominated purely based on her ability to, you know, exhaust the opponent, essentially, you know what I mean? Rather than her sort of technical skills. And I think that's what we should have a problem with. And that's where we see the sort of like the unfairness on the side of that contest.
Yeah, and obviously I'm not a medical professional, as this may shock everyone to hear, but you don't know how much of her strength and her structure she's retained from her life as a man. Now, obviously she's gone through hormone replacement therapy and she's gone through all the necessary steps to make a transition, but you don't know how strong she is compared to what she was before. No one would sanction a man versus a woman. I think it maybe has happened once or twice. But it's real like freak show stuff. You know, it's not supposed to be this thing that's pushed to the forefront of, oh, this is acceptable. This is great. This person served for the US, USA, USA, tragic personal. Like, the whole vibe of the show was to get you on side with this idea. And I was just thinking it was appalling, really. I mean, I want everyone to like live their own lives and all that, but I don't agree with it at all, man. It's just a bit depressing, to be fair, for me.
Yeah, well, so we move on that note.
And, yeah.
So number five, the NFL season started with a bang on Sunday with lots of unexpected results all over the country. However, something else that was entirely unexpected was the sighting of a gigantic virtual reality panther brought to life via the in-stadium video boards and pumped through the sound system. So this match in the Panthers' home stadium in Charlotte, North Carolina, featured the debut of an Unreal Engine panther that jumps around the stadium interior and roof, pausing only to rip up a virtual New York Jets banner. Probably a good job that they managed to edge the Jets 19-14, wasn't it? Or, you know, it probably would have been a little awkward if they didn't win that.
Sick, as if they're doing that, man. That's the next level. Forget all these fireworks and that. Imagine if they start doing that in all large-scale sporting events. That'd be absolutely sick, man. Do they do that at esports and stuff?
I don't know, probably. I wouldn't be surprised. You know what I mean? Seeing as it's got the sort of like gaming connotations, obviously using the Unreal Engine, which is a gaming editing platform. I'm not really sure exactly how they've done it, to be honest. Whether it was sort of like augmented reality with their phones. I'm not.
Is it like the two-pack hologram type of thing?
Or... Yeah, I think so. But I can't imagine, like, if you've watched the video and anybody, like, go and watch it, because it is strange. The animations are pretty horrible, to be honest. But like, it is pretty incredible how they've done it. I'm not sure. I'm not privy to the exact information of, like, how they did it. So it is quite an interesting concept. And I wonder if more sort of sporting teams and franchises will try and, you know, adopt something similar.
Mate, we're nearly in Ready Player One, aren't we, man? So
basically, yeah. All right, so that is it for the five things. We're going to move on and we're going to start talking about the tennis. So we're going to open with the tennis. So obviously 18-year-old Emma Raducanu, she's been the talk of the town really for the last sort of week since her win against Leila Fernandez, 19-year-old Leila Fernandez. So two teenagers in the US Women's Open final at Flushing Meadows. She sets a whole host of records on the way to becoming the first British woman since Virginia Wade in 1977 to win a Grand Slam. She also became the first woman in the Open era to win the title through qualifying, a feat which has never happened even in the men's. So she's moved up 137 places in the rankings and has become a national hero in the process. Jim, where do you think this ranks on the all-time great British sporting achievements?
Before we get into that, I absolutely agree with you. People... the media have really latched on to Emma Raducanu. There's obviously a load of factors involved. Her age, for one, as you've mentioned, but also she's a good-looking girl. She seems quite relatable. She's got mixed heritage. She ticks a lot of boxes in terms of mainstream, modern media appeal. But in terms of where she sits in the list of all-time British sporting achievements, I find that quite difficult to categorise because there are so many factors in play. And I was trying to cast my mind back of the most famous instances of when British sports people have absolutely smashed it. And I came up with a few examples. Nigel Mansell, he became F1 champ in 1992. The next year, he came third in the Indy 500. And to my knowledge, no one has done that kind of cross-pollinization in terms of racing. I think Kimi Raikkonen got into rallying, but I don't think he was that good. And he's like two or three-time F1 champion. But that's pretty rare to do it one year after the other as well. So he absolutely smashed it and a pioneer in that sense. And then obviously one for the boxing for me, Randy Turpin beat Sugar Ray Robinson for the middleweight title in 1951. He dropped it straight back in the rematch, but Robinson had only lost a single fight in 132 bouts up to that point. And Robinson is still widely considered pound for pound the greatest fighter who ever lived. And that for me is a gargantuan achievement. But how about this one? Steve Redgrave won gold medals in the rowing at five consecutive Olympic Games between 1984 and 2000, which is absolutely astounding. Then there's the World Cup winners from 1966. And, you know, there are so many examples. And I know what you mean in terms of perceived chances of a winning beforehand versus the result and her age. But I honestly don't know where I place that in terms of all-time achievement. And I think tennis is known for its prodigies. There are a lot of young achievers in the sport. So I'm not sure how rare of a thing it is or if we're just latching onto it because we're claiming her as British. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, talking from an odds perspective as well, like 400-1 she was. So that's a huge, huge price for an individual sporting event, I think. Absolutely massive. But as you say, like Steve Redgrave, like 5 gold medals consecutively during that, you know, a 16-year time period is absolutely incredible, really, isn't it?
That's like, a mad one. That is a mad one. When I looked that up, I was like, I didn't realise why Steve Redgrave was such a big deal back in the day. And now I can actually comprehend that. That is unbelievable. No, and he looked like someone's dad rowing in the Sydney Olympics, like just chilling, absolutely blasting down the river, killing it, man.
There's always sort of that when you're doing sort of like a cross comparison between sports. There's always like a lot of factors that you got to factor in the level of ability with the opponents, how much funding's put into the sport. So it's a nice thing to sort of like theorize over, but it is very difficult to sort of like narrow it down. But I mean, you know, talking about the quality and sort of like the emergence of like, you know, the young, inexperienced stars in the tennis, is this sort of like the sign of youth? Is that have they got another layer to their mental game, or are they dealing better with the fact that there's no real pressure to succeed? Because we saw some of the players that the two youngsters came up against, both Leila Fernandez and Emma Raducanu. You know, they came up against, I'm not sure where, Ash Barty, did she get beat by Leila Fernandez? And obviously Emma Raducanu beat the Greek girl in the semi-final. So, you know, the sort of like top, say, 10 players, you know, Sabalenka, I think she got beat by Leila Fernandez. So was there a lot more pressure on them, the girls that were in the sort of like top 10 in the rankings, than there was on perhaps the youngsters?
I think there's a certain personality type that's quite impetuous. Like, remember Wayne Rooney? He made his debut at 16 and scored a worldie against like a top level Arsenal team. Like, some kids are just fearless, and you can put them in under the brightest lights on the biggest stage and they don't give a shit. So Raducanu, yeah, Leila Fernandez, like, she's only a nipper as well. They've been bred to play tennis. Like, they've probably had mental coaches from the age of like 10. Do you know what I mean? So the crowd, the occasion, the pressure, they're probably experts, or they've been drilled repeatedly into how to deal with that. They've probably got mindfulness coaches and all that. So it's hard. Again, it's hard to say whether that's baseline personality or whether it's such a fundamental part of the whole tennis coaching setup. Like, in golf, that's massive as well, isn't it? Like, freeze everyone out, just play your shot, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I think it's part of each, really. I think you do have to be a certain personality type not to freeze on the big occasion, though, I'll say that.
And how important do you think transferable skills are as well? Because I've been reading a lot of that Raducanu. She's like, I saw a golf swing the other day. Like, she looks like she could quite easily like move into the sort of like into the golfing arena. Apparently, she's a big petrol head. She loves like Formula One. And I think she did horse riding and all sorts of these different sort of sports. I wonder how important it is for sports people, for elite sports people, even at a young age, to have like accumulated all this knowledge, all this experience, all these skills from different sports and be able to transfer them between the different sort of sporting events that they play. And I think that must have a big impact on their sort of performance.
Yeah, you find that about a lot of elite level sports people up until a certain age. They all play different sports. Like Cole Frampton, Katie Taylor, they were massive football players. I think Kurt Angle, the WWE wrestler, he was like sick at basketball, sick at American football, and just chose wrestling because that's what he liked, didn't it? And that's what his dad was into. Michael Jordan, you know, he'd love playing baseball as well. Mm. I think there's definitely something to that. But all those sports you've mentioned, which just popped into my head about Raducanu, they're all posh people sports, what you mentioned. Tennis, golf, F1. They've got the moolah, man. So
yeah, she got dough.
Yeah, exactly. So it's all there's a certain aspect of how much opportunity do you have to play these sports as well. I think that comes into it.
There was another one that sprung to mind was Kyler Murray. He's a quarterback for Arizona. He, I think, got drafted when he was 18. I think he got drafted in the MLB for the Oakland Athletics, but he chose not to sign a contract. And then I think it was the next year he got drafted in the NFL. So
mad.
I think he's only the second person in history to do that. So he could have played MLB, he could have played professional baseball, and now he's gone on to play professional football, and he's killing it as well. Like, I think he scored 5 touchdowns on the weekend. So like, obviously, like, it's mad to think that people have got that much talent to be able to like play 2 sports at such an elite level.
Well, when it comes to the tennis specifically, we are definitely in a transitional period. Like, the Williams sisters, they're pretty much done and dusted now, aren't they? So Raducanu is coming through, Fernandez is coming through, Djokovic, the Serbian Steelmeister International, He got done over by Medvedev, who we spoke about a couple of weeks ago, or spoke about him several times, actually. He's been popping up for a little while as someone to watch. As a closet tennis fan, I'm not that deep into the rankings and who's winning what. How did you... You watched the final, didn't you?
I watched a little bit of the men's and I saw some highlights. Obviously, Djokovic, he was looking to sort of get his record 21st Grand Slam title, wasn't he? And complete the men's calendar, which would have overtaken Rafael Nadal and Federer. Yeah, so, you know... He would have completed the first men's calendar Grand Slam, which is winning the Australian Open, French Open, Wimbledon and US Open all in the same year, I believe. The first person since Rod Laver in 1969 to do that. So this title would have been essentially, you know, made him the greatest tennis player of all time based on his achievements. No matter how, I could see you scrunching your face up already. So something that he will definitely be looking to put right in February next year when the Australian Open comes back round, which he has won 9 times, by the way. So why are you switching your face up? Because he's like, if he wins the most titles, he wins the most Grand Slams of any man in the history of the sport, how can you not call him the greatest?
Nah, that's not why I'm scrunching my face up. I was thinking to myself, I could see him winning the Australian, French, US, Wimbledon. I can see him winning several more of them. But to do it in all of them in a year, things have got to line up for you pretty nicely to do that. Do you know what I mean? And I thought that's got to be so gutting because he's getting up there in age now. He's at the point where obviously his mental game's there, his emotional game is there, his experience is there, but now his physical level is just starting to dip. And now his prime's probably just coming to an end. I could be speaking too soon. He could absolutely smash it next year, but this is the perception I've got. And he just might have missed it. But like I was scrunching my face because it was a bit of a galling thought.
I thought you were about to give me a tirade and how stylistically Roger Federer is just like a much better tennis player.
Oh, no, stylistically,
you
know I mean?
You
prefer
him. You can't really argue with that. Do you know what I mean? Because like he was beautiful to watch, Federer was. I think it's quite interesting. Obviously, Novak Djokovic maybe got 2-3 years left in him total. You know, it's difficult to keep that level of achievement up for any sort of like longer past, what is he, 34 or something like that now? So it's...
I mean, it'd do well to replicate the form he's shown this year. And even that's probably like 1 or 2 years past where you would expect someone to be able to exhibit that kind of form. So I hope his chance comes again, man. I really do, because I admire people who are able to stay at the top level for a long time. I think it's really impressive. And it's like, it's rare. You have to be a rare type of person to do it. And I enjoy watching rareness come into the world. It's like uplifting.
And I wonder how much Medvedev's victory will sort of thrust him into the sort of limelight of tennis, because they, in all sports, you need your sort of, you know, your leading players, your carrying players. So obviously that's what they're trying to do with Raducanu now. They're clearly trying to build her up as being the next sort of sweetheart of tennis, isn't it?
Think about this. It's an unforgiving game, man. Naomi Osaka, scrap heap. She was the darling of the tennis world about 8 months ago.
Probably less than that, isn't it? Like probably like 3 months ago, just before basically the French Open, what was just a month before Wimbledon. You know, you look a month before that, yeah, you're looking at her being the sort of like, she's carrying the torch for the women's game in tennis. And now, like, you know, you don't even know, like, you're not even hearing about it. How funny is that?
It's ruthless is what it is. Yeah. Funny. It's like the next one, who can we push? Who can we get on the cover of Vogue? Who can we get talking about? So I'm telling you, man, it's a dirty, dirty business, man. Proper. But I'm happy for Raducanu. Obviously, it's a lifelong dream and all that. But it's just, you can't take too much notice of that. You just got to keep winning games, innit? And if you become popular, then sound.
Well, that's the most important thing about it, isn't it? The more you win, the more limelight you're going to receive at the end of the day. No matter, you know, if people like you or not, because Djokovic hasn't been the most likable person, you know, since he's been winning. But people can't deny how much he's achieved. So how does it work with, you know, him being considered the best of all time? So, you know, how much credit does he get in comparison to someone like Federer or Nadal? You know, just give me your thoughts on it, really, because I just want to know, like, where you see them three. If you were going to put them three into a top three.
Well, I'd definitely rank Nadal at the bottom of those three, purely because of injuries and, you know, he's more of a clay player as well. And kind of, I don't want to call him one-dimensional, but there are certain aspects to him where you wouldn't put him against anyone in history and go like, yeah, he'd smash him. I think Federer and Djokovic, you could pretty much time for first. I mean, stylistically, I prefer Federer. He's just graceful and inventive, stylish. He's a bit swish, bit of a cocky cunt. Do you know what I mean? Bit of a personality about him. But Djokovic is like, he's like the Terminator, isn't he? There's no stopping him.
He's the Ronaldo of like tennis in a way, isn't he?
Yeah,
I think
exactly. So I wouldn't begrudge anyone placing Djokovic above Federer, but I prefer Federer.
Oh, awesome. All right, so we'll move on to the footy talk. And the Premier League is back with a bang after the dreaded international break.
yeah, exactly.
Because it was, you know, nobody wanted it. Like that first international break at the start of the season, you're just getting warmed up into the new Premier League fixtures, three games in. Oh, England versus Andorra. You know what I mean? England versus San Marino. I can't even remember who they beat in that first game. I know they drew to Poland, didn't they, in the last one?
Let's talk about the lads, man. Let's talk about the real footy.
Talk about the real goats. Ronnie, man. Ronnie Brace on his debut for United. Then he goes and scores in the Champions League last night. We will talk about Man United for quite a considerable amount of time in a little bit. But we'll stick with the Premier League for now. Just like how obvious was that the most obvious thing, Ronnie scoring that brace for United on his debut?
Not for me, you know. Because I was thinking, obviously, there's a massive difference between the Premier League and the Italian League. And all that pressure and hype, I was thinking, is this just going to be one massive wet fart and he just doesn't do anything? But obviously, the man's a modern great for a reason. He was absolutely electric when he met. Poacher's goal for the first one. And then second one, first touch, bit of strength, bang, straight through the keeper's legs. And I was watching the highlights next to India. And I was going, oh, vintage. And she was looking at me like, what the fuck are you on about? I was like, look, he's a don, man. He's an absolute don. He's probably like, he's up there as one of my favourites of all time because he owns the moment. And in his post-match interview, he's like, yeah, I expected one. I didn't expect two. He's like, yeah, come on, son. Give it to the boys.
He's got that that crazy elite mentality, hasn't he? I mean, I was thinking that both goals had a little element of luck to him. But then I was thinking, mate, you make your own luck in sport, don't you?
He reacted so quickly to that first one. And the second one, yeah, maybe. Going through the keeper's legs like that. But then that's how he scored against Young Boys as well. Do you know what I mean? He just gets it on target, drives it low with pace, with little backlift. And the keepers are just caught on the hop a little bit.
Yep.
There's no way he got lucky both times for that, man. He knows what he's doing.
All right, so we'll move on to Leeds versus Liverpool. So, you know, Leeds were humbled by Liverpool again. Obviously, they're not doing very well. I think 1 point from four games. Questions about Marcelo Bielsa, whether he's sort of like, you know, his methodology, his philosophy when it comes to playing football is going to last at someone like Leeds. But the main, you know, the main overshadowing point of that game was the Harvey Elliott injury. Obviously, 18 years old, suffered a nasty injury. There was a lot of backlash from certain Liverpool fans. You know, should it have been a red card first off for Pascal Struijk? You know, I didn't really see when I first saw it, I didn't really see it as a particularly egregious challenge, to be honest. I thought, all right, he's won the ball. And then obviously you see what happened to his ankle. He's got sort of like caught up under, I think, his trailing leg. And it wasn't really from behind. It was kind of from the side, wasn't it? He sort of wrapped his leg around to win the ball. Obviously, we saw some backlash from that fan on Twitter, which is a young lad who was getting a bit too excited.
That floppy-headed little shit. He's going, everyone who should be associated with Leeds should be ashamed of themselves. And the first thing you see after that lad gets taken off on a stretcher is all the Leeds fans applauding him, like wishing him well on his way. In terms of the tackle itself, I can see why it was a red. Even though he was coming in kind of from the side, he was also kind of coming in from the back as well. And he did catch him, fair enough. There was nothing malicious in that, man.
No, wasn't. There was no intention there. That's what I'm saying. He was sent off. I would assume the rule that he was sent off by was, you know, an attempt like, what do they call it? Sort of like a malicious intent to do harm or whatever. I don't see that
yeah,
happened.
I didn't see
so,
that either.
In my opinion, I don't know what rule there was in football to warrant that as being a red card, a yellow card for sure. But at the end of the day, he's won the ball. All right, yeah, he did catch him as well. And we see that quite a lot. But for me, it wasn't sort of a malicious challenge. It wasn't like a really, he wasn't endangering that player. I just think it was really unfortunate that he got his leg sort of caught under, caught under his trailing leg or whatever, and that's what caused the injury. I mean, even Harvey Elliott has come out on Twitter and said that when Leeds tried to get his red card overturned and that appeal was denied for whatever reason, I don't know who makes these decisions. I guess a panel of experts.
quote unquote experts.
So Harvey Elliott came out and said, "Oh, you know that's not the right decision. You know, sort of you'll come back stronger, this and that." And I thought, what a mature thing for Harvey Elliott to say as an 18-year-old to say to Struijk, oh, I hope you come back stronger. And it's just like, You know, this good guy's luck. Just broke his whatever it was, ankle, leg. And he's saying to Pascal Strott, I hope you come back stronger after your 3-game ban. So, you know, fair play to Harvey Elliott, but I think Liverpool fans were definitely completely blowing this out of context.
Yeah, for sure. And in terms of where Leeds are at this point in the season, they've had Man U and Liverpool and they've got absolutely smashed. Like, who else have they played? I'm sure they drew a game, Leeds. They've definitely drew a game and I think they might have won one as well. So I don't know why everyone's panicking. There's so many games left to play in the season.
Yeah, there's a long way to go. I think they are only on 1 point, though, aren't they, after 4 games? I'm not entirely sure, but I'm sure they're down there.
But if two of those games are against Liverpool and United, and United were absolutely flying on the opening day, first day back at Old Trafford with fans in the building, and that is a serious United attacking lineup. And Liverpool are looking like the team they were a couple of seasons ago. There's no shame in getting battered by those teams. So I think that's a little bit premature, man.
Yeah, I think Gary Neville's come out and said recently, you know, are the four best teams in the world right now in the Premier League? You know, Man City, Man United, Liverpool, and the other one would probably be Chelsea. So, you know, is he talking about, you know, Premier League really being that elite level, like that we've kind of assumed that the Premier League's always been like the most competitive league in Europe, but, you know, we've never really sort of like spoke about the four best teams in the world being from there, because we've always had Bayern Munich that dominated European football. Barcelona and Real Madrid have, you know, for the last, you know, couple of decades, well, at least the last 10 years, dominated European football as well. So, you know, it's interesting to see how, you know, how the sort of Champions League is going to reflect on that. Obviously, Barcelona got smashed 3-0 by Bayern Munich. We're going to talk about that in a sec. But Damari Gray continues to impress for Everton. He has to get mentioned, scores his third game in 4 appearances. He has to be considered the sign of the season. 1.7 million. He's already made that money back. Absolute daylight robbery, man, to get in for 1.7 million. 26 years old from Bayer Leverkusen.
Mate, crazy. his first touch for that goal, man. That was like a FIFA flick the right stick on it, man. Straight as an arrow. There was absolutely no danger of him missing that. I don't know who got paid off in the back room. I don't know who's got some information on whoever, who's shagging whose wife. Do you know what I mean? There's something going on there for him to go for 1.7 million. It's mad. I'm glad for Everton. I'm happy for him.
And what a ball from Decore as well. What a pass from Decore.
Everton are looking sick. Everton are looking so sick, man.
But unbelievably, Bayer Leverkusen paid the same amount for him, 1.7 million from obviously Leicester. Because obviously he went from Blues to Leicester. I think that was probably about 5 mil. Can't remember exactly. But honestly, his transfer value has been really, really low throughout his career for some unknown reason. But if he continues this goal scoring form for Everton, mate, you're going to be looking at him being worth 35 mil the next time. You know what I mean? He's still only
probably more.
You know, say next season, say he goes and scores 15 goals, 5 assists this season. He's probably, as you say, could be worth 40 million. He's going to be 27. They could sell him to, like, you know, whoever, like a big club. Fair play to him, and he's killing it. You know, he could be looking at getting his way back in the England team as well if his form continues.
Depends if he can do it in the Champions League, though. Segway.
Oh, he loves it. He loves it. So, I mean, goals galore at City, mate. Goals galore at City. 9.
I've just watched the highlights just now, man. And you know what? What's that lad's name for Leipzig who scored the hat-trick? What's his name?
Nkunku.
He was looking unreal, man.
What a great hat-trick. Yeah, two great headers. Unbelievable movement for the third one. To make that little run off the player. Receive it low. And drive it low in the bottom corner. Yeah, he's going to be on a lot of big teams' radar. You know, it doesn't matter, does it, how many goals you concede when you can score 6? You know, against RB Leipzig, who, yeah, they're a decent team. Obviously, the coach by Jesse Marsh, the American. They're not as good as they have been in previous years because they sold Upa, obviously we spoke about Upamecano, he went to Bayern Munich, and the other guy, I think it's Konate, he went to Liverpool, was it? So they sold their two best centre-backs, essentially, do you know what I mean? So you can understand why they've got problems defensively, but just like City, and it just being City, Jack Grealish with a great, great goal.
That was a sick goal, man. Yeah. Even though he got a bollocking off Pep on the sidelines for some reason.
Yeah, he's not the brightest spark. He's not the brightest spark, is he? Really shown.
He's so jokes, man. He just looks like he's just living in the moment like a puppy. It's great. And he could just curl one in for it. That was a sick goal, man. And you know what? I think it was the fifth or the sixth goal where Sterling took the free kick short. Grealish found the pass out to the middle. He's integral, man. If they end up winning the Champions League and he is perceived to be the deciding factor, the missing piece of the puzzle, That's 100 mil well spent, man.
And Liverpool as well. So, you know, they had a comeback win. Obviously, they were all over AC Milan in that first half, but managed to go in, I think, 2-1 down after like two clinical sort of counterattacks. Actually, was one a corner, but the first was definitely a clinical counterattack from AC Milan. But, you know, they managed to get their way back into the game, 1-3-2. A big result for Liverpool, wouldn't you say? Because they got a really tough group, haven't they?
My boy Rebic scored, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, actually. The guy that, yeah, you were waxing lyrical about.
I watched the Lazio AC Milan highlights last week, and some of the passes he was playing, I've never seen the guy before. Obviously, I'm not deep into the Italian league. I thought I'd definitely ask, like, tell Bissett about this one. He was looking outrageous, and I was happy to see him score. I haven't watched any of the footage. I was following the live commentary in the group chat. Was Henderson's goal as good as Joe Barr said it was?
Oh, yeah, it was a great strike. Yeah, I think that was from a corner. I think it's come out and he's just hit it on the half volley, smashed it into the bottom corner. It was a great finish, to be honest, because they've got to play Atletico Madrid. Tough group. It's a really, really tough group. So they needed to get off to a winning start. And it was looking pretty, it was looking like they probably weren't going to do that after the first half. But AC Milan, once again, I think they're going to be a test for the other two teams in that group as well. And, you know, finally, we'll talk about PSG before we move on to sort of, the United, really deconstructing the United performance. PSG, how have they managed to not beat Club Brugge with that team? Oh, I sent it to you earlier. Like, yeah, they've got so much quality in that team. Obviously, you've got Neymar, Mbappe and Messi as your front three. They're playing ultimate team, basically, yeah. FIFA ultimate team in real life. They've got Gigi Wijnaldum in midfield with Ander Herrera. Who's the other one that plays in midfield?
You got Wijnaldum, Paredes and Herrera.
Yeah.
And you got Kimpembe, Marquinhos at centre-back, Hakimi at right-back, Diallo left-back, Neymar, Mbappe and Messi up top. Messi got a yellow card?
Yeah, possibly. I don't know what that was for. But, you know, if you back in the day when you're playing LMA Manager or whatever, or like FIFA, and you want to use a few cheats.
That's one for the kids, that is. That's one for the kids, LMA Manager.
And you want to use a few cheats. You know, you put the cheat code in at the start that gives you like 500 million to start off with when you're Burton Albion or whatever. They're the players that you would buy, like, if you want to make like an elite team. They had, I looked at the stats, like Club Brugge has 17 shots on target. So 17 shots a goal. Let's say a handful on target. I think they had 6 shots total, like on goal, and I think only 3 on target. So I'm like, they had 69% possession, but possession means nothing when you're not winning games. With a team like that, they should be absolutely dominating teams like Club Brugge.
No, but I'm telling you though, I said to you a few weeks ago, it's not an easy thing amalgamating all that talent into one team. The classic Barcelona team, classic is about 12 years ago, but that classic Barcelona team, they came up together. They got sick together. I think it's quite rare that you can just buy a sick team and make it work. Of all the great teams that have spent a lot of money, there's always been a kind of backbone that have made it work. Even if you have got a lot of superfluous players, a lot of big money signings, there does have to be some kind of foundation. The PSG, they've been steadily building for a while. I mean, they'll build, like, Di Maria went a few years ago. Andrew Herrera went a few years ago. Hakimi, Messi, they're this year, and they went out on this year. Neymar's been there a few years. Mbappe's been there a few years.
They've still got players like Draxler as well. Like, they've got a B team, right, that they put out in Ligue 1. And they beat everybody.
It doesn't surprise me that they've stuttered against a team like Club Brugge, where they've probably thought, we'll fucking walk this. We're going to spank these lads. And they just didn't go their way. And then people start pointing fingers. There's a lot of egos there. You know, no one's telling me. Messi's got this reputation as this humble player. No one's telling me he hasn't got an ego. Just because he doesn't show it out there like Ronaldo, getting his thighs out and all that shit. He's got his own ego. Neymar certainly got an ego. Mbappe certainly got an ego. Do you know what I mean? So that's, I think the personalities in that team are just as difficult to juggle as to how you mesh their attributes and their footballing abilities. Like, Pochettino's got a big job on his hands there because there's a lot of expectation. People are expecting them to be smashing teams. Absolutely. And when you stutter at stages like this, it's difficult, man. They need to get results quickly and win impressively. I don't envy him at all.
Nah, I don't. And, you know, even Thomas Tuchel, he didn't get much time, did he? I think was he there just over 12 months or around that time? He weren't there long anyway. So he didn't really get the benefit of the doubt. I don't think Pochettino will either if he doesn't start winning matches. Obviously, the French league, that has to happen. You know,
even taken for granted, isn't it?
Yeah, it didn't. They didn't win it last year. Miraculously, like somehow Lille managed to win it, because that's atrocious. Really, the fact that they can't win that league, they should be winning that league for the next 10 years consecutively. You know, as like a side note, a footnote to what is the real thing that the owners want, the Qatari owners, they want to win the Champions League. That is, they don't care about the French league, really. So, you know, Pochettino, if he didn't win the French league and he managed to win the Champions League, you would keep his job. Absolutely. Because that's the most important thing. But for me at the moment, if he's not getting the best out of those players and it continues that way, say they don't win the next two Champions League matches, and God forbid if they went out in the Champions League group stage, like I think he'd be gone straight away. I think they'd just get rid of him. As soon as he doesn't qualify for the qualifying rounds of Champions League, they'd sack him off straight away.
That's a good shout. You know, we'll have to put a little pin in that, innit? See if it comes true.
Yeah. All right. So Sebastian Haller, who was a bit of a flop for West Ham, he scored 4 for Ajax yesterday as they romped Sporting Lisbon 5-1. So this was pretty interesting because I like a player that sort of didn't quite make it in the Premier League that goes on and does really well. And obviously scoring 4 in a Champions League group game is no mean feat, and he must be one of the only players to do that. I mean, I do remember there was a Shakhtar Donetsk player that did it, and I'm sure Ronaldo's probably done it at some point.
Of course he has. Of course he has.
Must have. Maybe Zlatan. I think Zlatan might have scored 4 at one point. But, you know, fair play to 15 goals in 23 appearances. Ajax look really, really good. I love that team, Ajax.
I was just about to say, I've got a proper soft spot for Ajax, man. They're sick. Do you remember a few years ago, they got to the semis against Tottenham? Yeah. And it was only like a
Lucas Moura hat-trick.
Yeah. And the last one was in like the 94th minute.
Yeah.
And they were absolutely playing Spurs off the park for an hour. I remember watching that at Joe's house thinking, Jesus, man, Ajax, are we going back to Johan Cruyff days or what, man? This team's unreal, Danny van der Beek. So I've got a real soft spot for them. Bear in mind, they've also got the Bob Marley-infused third alternate kit. So, you know, there's a lot to like about that. They're from the bud-smoking capital of Europe as well.
And like footballing-wise, they've got that sort of Cruyffian philosophy that they brought up. You know, they sort of, they have the same philosophy with their U8s all the way up to the first team, man. And like, I just love the fact that clubs have got that, and they sort of like, they bring the players up for the youth a little bit like Barcelona. And there's that connection with the sort of, with the Cruyffian philosophy. But talking of Barcelona, what an awful result for them. Like they were absolutely terrible against Bayern Munich and they got completely destroyed.
The result is not as worrying as soon as that first goal went in. You saw the look on the players' faces and they just wanted to get out of there, didn't they? They were like, oh, not this again. They were expecting it to come apart at the seams, weren't they? And as soon as that first goal went in, I mean, PK must be disgusted with them all, man. Because he's an old school Don, loves winning, is used to winning. He's like one of the greatest defenders of all time. And he's surrounded by these fucking no-marks, man, who Barcelona are only playing because the wage bill got too high.
Yeah, like Luke de Jong, like this, he has no business being in a Barcelona shirt. You know, even players like Marcus Braithwaite, even though he's done well, no business being in a Barcelona shirt. So it's quite sad, really, like looking at it. Do you know what I mean? I feel a little bit sorry for the fans the way it's gone because you know, huge club, man, huge club. Like they've just been a constant, a constant juggernaut, really, in the world of football, like throughout our lives. So it's quite sad to see him just being sort of like writ off by these sort of, you know, this is a game where, all right, 5 years ago, they'd be expecting to win. Do you know what I mean? And now, like, the fans are probably thinking, oh, Bayern Munich, man.
Bayern were flying, though, and they have been for a long time. Gnabry's unreal. Lewandowski's unreal. Müller, he's still going unreal. Do you know what I mean? They're a done team. There's no shame in losing to them. The thing that disappointed me was Barcelona's, again, I'm projecting this, but it seemed like they had a lack of ambition. And they were just like, oh, can we just get this over with now and just go back and beat like Celta Vigo and feel good about ourselves? You know what I mean? They're not the Barcelona team of old.
Yeah, you wouldn't put any money on them winning the Champions League this year, would you?
No way, man. Absolutely not. You'd be a fool to do that. Not even the most diehard Barcelona fan would do that.
And it'd be interesting to see who the favourites are. Like, I haven't looked at the betting odds because obviously PSG went to 3-1 favourites. You can guarantee that they're not favourites to win the Champions League now, even after game week one. A team that should have done a lot better. Obviously, Chelsea made a good defence, a good title defence. They won 1-0. But another team that probably would have been one of the favourites was Man United. And that all went horribly wrong, didn't it? Obviously, we're going to talk about Ole. Like, did he tactically get it right after the Wan-Bissaka sending off? United should have been competitive and comfortable, even with the man down with 45 minutes left to play, 1-0 up. So based on the quality that they have within that squad, you know, should they have been looking to do better?
I think that's quite a harsh assessment, because when did Wan-Bissaka get sent off?
I think it was the first 38th minute, something like that.
They held on for an hour, like with 10 men. You can say it's United versus Young Boys all you want, but that extra man counts a lot all over the pitch. And if you examine the circumstances of the goal, Jesse Lingard's played it back. You couldn't have split the defence better if you were like Zidane in his prime. Do you know what I mean? It was so unfortunate. Great finish as well. I just think the timing of it, like, was it 95 minutes? The way it happened, the fact that it was, again, the Ronaldo party still going on, you know, there's a lot of expectation. And I think it seems like a bigger defeat than it is. I think if a few weeks from now, put it in perspective, you know, anyone can make that cut. It was a bad back pass, but I think it was like a perfect storm to be like, oh, he's made the wrong decision. Fucking United should have done better. I really don't see it that way. And also, I didn't realise that Young Boys have an artificial pitch.
Yeah, I did clock that. Yeah, I did clock that. It didn't look like grass. I was thinking, yeah, that looks too pristine to be grass. So obviously that's going to make a difference. But
I think it makes a big difference, man.
These are elite professional footballers we're talking about. And, you know, I feel like the quality of personnel that Ole has at his disposal, he should have been able to get them over the line, especially being 1-0 up. He took Jadon Sancho off immediately for Diego Dalo, who's a right back. So he immediately replaced Wan-Bissaka's position.
Which is what you'd say is the right thing to do.
Yeah, I'd say that's the correct thing to do. But I think he went to a back five at half time though, because he took off Donny van der Beek, who he's having a torrid time at United. Like, you know, he just can't get a game. And then even when he does get a game, gets hauled off at half time. They brought Varane on. So I think they went five at the back with three centre backs, Diego Dalo, Luke Shaw. And then he went ultra defensive, in my opinion. He took Ronnie off for Lingard, which baffles me slightly, because Ronaldo, obviously, the way he's started like a house on fire at United. So you would have thought you'd keep him on, because then he's also got the ability, like, we know it, Ronnie's got the ability to change, you know, change a game on it, flip a game on its head. He's always got that ability.
You want him to play the next game though, don't you? You can't play him on Saturday or a Sunday. They're playing midweek. He's 36, man. You want him to start the next game. Obviously, he's not going to be chasing down balls left, right and centre. But those 90 minutes add up. Look at what we've been saying about Harry Kane, man. He's like 10 years younger than Ronaldo.
I can't agree with that. I feel like he's an animal as well. Like, he's a freak of nature. And like, to leave him on for the last 20 minutes, because if you get a free kick 35 yards out, or, you know, you can slide him through just on that one chance, you know he's got the ability to change the game. Lingard, all right, he's a good player, yeah? And I'm not talking about, you know, I'm not going to sort of like throw in the sort of mistake in there, because that could happen to anybody. But he also took off Bruno Fernandes, perhaps their most creative player.
I'd say that's a bigger mistake than taking off
Matic. Yeah, for Matic, who's clearly a defensive player. So now you're playing five at the back and you've got Pogba, Fred and Matic in midfield. Yeah.
You're going nowhere with them, are you, really?
Yeah, Fred's fucking terrible, man. Like, I don't know what he's doing in Man United shirt. It's absolutely shocking. Like, when we spoke about him before, like last season, and the geezer is not getting any better, man. He's not improving. The geezer can't pass. I don't know what he does defensively. Man United fans, please tell me like what he does for the team. He did eventually get taken off for Martial, which is it's way too late for me. He shouldn't even be in the starting lineup. But, you know, for me, Solskjaer's substitutions were poor. His game management was poor after the sending off. And they deserve to get beat, Man United, because you put Jose Mourinho in charge of that team, right? 1-0 at halftime. 10 men, they do not lose that game under someone like Jose Mourinho. They would not lose that game.
Maybe.
Maybes. They wouldn't lose. I'm telling you, they would not lose. Jose Mourinho would be able to tactically figure that game out for the last 45 minutes. And there's no way they can see two goals and lose that game.
Yeah, but the game, the way it played out, suggests that tactically they were doing all right. And it was a freak occurrence and a decent finish. I think we're going to have to agree to disagree on this one. I think we are going to have to leave it there, because we could go around in circles about this all night. So I will bow to your superior football knowledge. I'll step away from this one for sure. But I know what you're saying. I don't completely disagree with you. But I think it was unfortunate for United, especially Lingard as well. Especially the season he had at West Ham last year as well. It's a fucking goalie, man. But yeah.
And he got a goal, didn't he? He got a goal. He scored against, was it Leeds, or he got a goal the last game, or
Newcastle
over the season? Yeah, Newcastle. That was it. He's already scored this season. So it's a bit unfortunate. And we'll see how it works with Ole going forward, because he's a bit like Pochettino in a way, but not to the same extremes. But he'll be judged on his ability to win games in the Champions League once again. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Obviously, they want to compete in the Premier League as well. But beating Newcastle 2-1 and beating Leeds 5-1, they're the results that aren't going to stick out in people's minds. It's going to be losing to Young Boys 2-1. And it's going to be whoever they're playing next, Villarreal or the other team that's in their group. If they don't win that game, he's going to be judged on that. So it's the Champions League, man. These big teams are judged on their performance in the Champions League. We've spoke about football for ages. We're going to move on. We're going to do a really, really quick NFL week one review. Just fire some tidbits of all the teams that played this weekend. So it was a great opening game between Bucks and the Cowboys. Dak Prescott back after that horrific leg injury last year, looking good as ever. But at the end of a loss to the Tom Brady and Gronk show, as they repeat last year's Super Bowl antics by combining for two touchdowns, Tom Brady must be drinking some elixir of life that we aren't privy to, Jim.
Man, I'm telling you, Tom Brady, don't even know anything about the NFL. He's my favorite NFL player of all time. I don't understand. How old is he now? Like 45 or something?
42. Legit 42. And like they were saying that his snap to release time, which is the time that he sort of hikes the ball and he goes to throw it, like that time hasn't changed since he first entered the league like 20 years ago. It hasn't changed.
That's outrageous. That just shows you that he's reading the pitch. They call it the field, don't they?
Yeah.
He must be reading the field like in slow motion. His perception of time must literally be like, he can see everything. The highlights that I've watched of him, he's fully happy to throw it short if it means he can get the yardage. His accuracy, he knows the percentages. Do you know what I mean? I think he's very intelligent. And again, longevity, as we're talking about with Djokovic, Federer, Ronaldo. He's a G, isn't he? I don't need to know much about the NFL to know he's an absolute don.
Now, you spot on, because there's a sports psychologist called, his name's like Shikshet Mahal. He's got a really long name. That's hard to pronounce. But he talks about flow, and that is what flow is. When sporting athletes, they feel like there's that slow motion. They're in that element of flow, and he seems to be in it all the time. Like he very rarely makes mistakes. And, there was Marcus Brathwaite a few years ago in the World Cup final for cricket. And he was talking about the same thing. He said, yeah, I just couldn't miss. I was just in this element of flow. I wasn't even thinking about what I was doing. I was just like unleashing these sixes and just smashing every ball. Do you know what I mean? He was just seeing it like a beach ball. I think Tom Brady, you can't argue with it. But, there was a big shot, talking about sort of like, the comparison between quarterbacks. There's another great quarterback, Aaron Rodgers, albeit I think he's only won one NFL ring in the same sort of period. He's only 35, 36. So he's about 7 years younger than Tom Brady, but he looks about 8 years older. So it's like crazy. You put a picture.
He loves a drink.
Yeah. You put the picture of these two up against each other. And the fact that his performance against, New Orleans Saints this weekend, he got beat 37-3. Like he couldn't even throw a touchdown. There's been a lot of speculation about Aaron Rodgers and whether he's going to stay in Green Bay next year. I don't think he even wanted to be there this year. And there's a lot of criticism about whether he's got the heart to carry on in Green Bay and go and win that NFL ring. Actually, I don't think he has won one with them. So we'll see what happens there. 74 points scored in the game between the 49ers and the Detroit Lions. Wide receiver Deebo Samuel with 189 receiving yards and a touchdown, as Detroit Lions secondary is non-existent. Decent debut for Jared Goff. After his switcheroo with Matthew Stafford in LA, as he used 9 different receivers and threw for 338 yards with 3 touchdowns and interception, successfully completing 38 out of 57 passes. Also, we still need to get you a team for the NFL. I forgot about that.
No, I picked one. I did pick a team, didn't I?
You might have, actually. I can't remember who it was. Was it not New Orleans?
What's their name? Their team
Saints.
Name?
Saints. Was it New Orleans Saints?
Maybe. I'm not sure. I don't know if I'm willing to troll the earlier episodes to find out what I said.
I was going to say, we'll have to delve into the back catalogue, the classic Ball Chat Sports episodes.
I might just pick a new one, to be fair.
Yeah, just pick a new one every week, man. Like I guess a lot of the fans do in the NFL anyway.
I'll pick a new one, and then I'll get on the group chat and piss off Piz and Pritchard about how I now like the NFL and I won't watch any of it and I'll just repeat what the commentator said.
They'd just be like, oh, do you see we just scored a touchdown? They'd be like,
who what?
All right, so there's a close call for the Chiefs at Arrowhead as they edge the Browns. Cleveland Browns, 33-29. Browns quarterback Baker Mayfield threw an interception at the death that handed the game to Kansas City. Tyreek Hill back to his imperious form, which has made him one of the best wide receivers in the league the last couple of seasons by gaining 197 yards and 11 receptions for a touchdown. So Chiefs were the team that lost to Tom Brady's Buccaneers in the final last year. They always look like they're gonna beat teams, man. Like, obviously, you got Patrick Mahomes as the quarterback. You know, he's sort of like got the threat on his feet. He's got a threat in the air. And Tyreek Hill is just like dominating. But you can guarantee him getting 100 yards every single game, which is a no mean feat for a wide receiver. So you're talking about elite players in their position. Tyreek Hill is becoming that player over the last couple of seasons to be the most like counted on wide receiver to get yardage. So really, really impressive for them. My Chicago Bears, acting more like teddy bears once again as they fall lifelessly to the LA Rams, 34-14. Wasn't a big shock for me. Fans are desperately calling out for our young quarterback and first-round draft pick, Justin Fields, before a ball had even been snapped in this year's season. So their voices will be heard loud and clear should we fail to beat the Bengals on Sunday. Matt Stafford, who is the guy that made the switch with Jared Goff, between the two teams. He had an impressive debut performance, but his stats were slightly inflated by some terrible coverage in the Bears secondary. That is to be expected when we let our best quarterback, cornerback go to Denver, sorry. So that is your NFL week one roundup. So next week, Jim, you're going to do a review on your team's performance in week two.
You need to remind me. I'll try and remember myself to pick a team. And then I'll actually try and watch some highlights, try and watch a bit of coverage and get an idea about what's actually going on.
I know who it is. You know why? Because you said Outcaster from there. It's Atlanta Falcons. That's your team.
Sweet.
I'm pretty sure it was because I'm sure you said Outcaster from Atlanta. So I'll support them.
Yeah, cool. I'm happy. And I like Birds of Prey as well. So
there
good.
You go. Perfect.
Who are the Falcons playing next week?
I mean, they got absolutely stuffed, I think, this week.
Hey, don't worry about it, man. The Falcons are G's.
But week two NFL, the Falcons are playing. They got absolutely stuffed. I'm sure they got stuffed last week. But, you know, let's hope they'll be a little bit better. They got Matt Ryan, the quarterback. I'm not sure who they got in terms of wide receivers because they used to have Julio Jones, which he was a bit of a don. But he's gone somewhere else now.
I'll do a bit of research, man.
Watch it. Watch it. Like, you know, they're not a great team, but you never know, man. I think they're going to be on the front end of it.
What time do they play at? Is it late?
So it's usually the main kickoff's at 1 o'clock, so 6 PM UK time. So that's perfect for you. You know what I mean? Just get on Piz. Piz loves it. Just go and watch it with Piz.
And Stitch as well. He loves it as well.
Yeah, he's mad on it as well because we're all in the fantasy football league.
I might actually get on it. It might be just an excuse to like just piss them all off about the NFL. Sweet.
Yeah, you proper wind them up if you go on like you know loads. I should do that. That'd be funny. All right, let's do the quiz. Let's do the quiz because I'm pretty hopeful and like I feel like it's becoming. I should want you to get points. Really, I know there's a competitive element to it, but yeah. I do want to try and do questions that you're gonna have a chance at. So I think you got potential to get at least three this week.
All right. Before we start the quiz. Let me just go and blow my nose and have a piss and grab another homebrew scrumpy and I'll be back about 30 seconds. But yeah, I share that sentiment. I'm never trying to fuck you out of points when it comes to the quiz.
Lies.
And I've got a good quit now. I've got a good quizzing podcast for you as well. I'll be back.
So you've got a potential of getting 8 points this week. So actually more than the 5 questions because there's a lot of half points in there. Do you know what I mean? So there's a few opportunities there for you, Jim.
Very generous, very generous. Little bit of scrumpy.
Little bit of scrumpy.
All right, I'm ready when you are. I got my timer on.
All right, so we've got 2 football questions, an NFL question, a tennis question, and a boxing question. How about that for sporting diversity?
I love that spread. Go on, hit me.
It's a good spread. So number one, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Last week saw the end of another fairly uneventful round of World Cup qualifiers. Can you tell me which nation has the most qualifying campaigns in both the World Cup and the European Championships without ever actually making it to the finals? A run which goes back to the 1934 World Cup qualifiers.
That is a good question. And they've never qualified?
They've never qualified for the actual finals of either the World Cup or the European Championships. If you need a clue, I'll give it you.
No, I'm going to go for it, man, I think. I'm gonna say Luxembourg.
Oh, you killed it. Is that a guess?
Yeah, why?
It is Luxembourg.
Mate, have a look at the stop timer as well. 29:45.
What an answer. Mate. What a guess. Fair play to you. Yeah, Luxembourg.
I was thinking it was going to be San Marino because I always hear about fucking San Marino.
Yeah, because they're always in it. Always in it, like. There you go. Off to an absolute blinder.
Mate, I'm telling you. I don't know where I pulled that from. Genuinely.
Yeah, the clue was going to be this: the capital city's name is the same as the country's name.
That would have threw me off. That would have threw me off.
Because obviously Luxembourg City is the capital of Luxembourg. So that would have been the clue. All right, so number two, because I thought that was going to be the hardest one. So I reckon you could be on for at least five here. As we mentioned earlier, Novak Djokovic was denied his 21st Grand Slam victory, temporarily halting him as the outright most winningest tennis player of all time. But I want to know how many times has he won the US Open? And you get half a point if you can name what years.
That's a harder question than the first one. Has he won the US Open 6 times?
Nope.
Oh, fuck. Okay, well, that was gone. So
you curious. Got a chance to have a few guesses. You can have...
Okay, 2011, 2013.
Half a point.
2015, 2021. No, he lasted shit. Fuck. 22.
All right, I'll give you a point because you got 2011 and 2015. He won it 3 times. He won it 2011, 2015, and 2018. So I'll give you
I'll
a point that. For that.
I'll yeah,
give
you I'll a take point. The, I'll take the point. Cheers.
All right, even though you were just reeling off random years. In the 2010s. But yeah, 2 points. 2 points. So yeah, you're halfway there. Halfway there. So it's going to be tough for me to beat this next week, I think, already, based on my previous form. All right, so number three is the NFL question. So this season, Troy Apke, I think that I'm pronouncing his name right, became the first white cornerback in the NFL since 2002. But can you tell me which team he plays for?
I'm trying to think of like the whitest areas of the US now.
It's got to be like Utah or Kansas.
Yeah, something like that. Is it... Do you need the team name as well?
If you give me the state...
Minnesota?
No, it's the Washington football team.
Ah, fuck it.
All right, that was a swing and a miss. I thought you might have known that because I do remember us talking about it. So I was wondering if you sort of, you know, looked at, did a little research on it or whatever. All right, number four is your boxing question. So
pressure is on.
We are about to cover Evander Holyfield's triller bout against former MMA fighter Vitor Belfort shortly. But prior to that, I want to know in what year Holyfield delivered Riddick Bowe his only ever professional loss.
That's a good question, man. That is a very good question. I am going to have to say 1994.
I'm going to give you half a point.
Don't give me half a point.
You're one year off, though, man.
It's very generous of you, but I can't accept the half point. Okay, I should have known. Right. I'm happy I was close because I was thinking, Tyson last in 91 or 1990 to Buster Douglas. And then I was trying to go from there. And then,
We'll keep the high level of competency we've had.
Yeah.
And we won't give out the half points for near misses then. All right. So your last one is a football question. So what, you on two?
I'm on two now, yeah.
This is the one where you could potentially get some points. Right. So Erling Haaland, a guy that we spoke about earlier, he's moved within 12 goals of John Crew's 24 international goals for Norway at the tender age of 21. And I'm going to give you, Jim, half a point for any of these players in the Norway top 10 all-time goal scorers that you can name. I'm going to give you 60 seconds for this because obviously there's a lot of opportunities there and you need to have a think because I think 30 seconds is not long enough. So any players, apart from John Carew, obviously, so you've got another 9 players there that you could potentially get points for. 3, 2, 1, off you go.
There's absolutely no way I'm going to get this.
Honestly, nah, they're your era. There's 2 or 3 that are your era, mate.
Pedersen. More against Pedersen. Is he even Norwegian?
I don't know. Yes, he's 10. He's 10. Ah. Yes. Half a point. He's number 10. Just got in.
Berg. Someone Berg. B-E-R-G. Berg.
There's no Bergers there.
No Bergers there. You know, I was watching not too long ago when they scored against Brazil in 1998, and I just can't remember the geezer's name. God, I think these last 20 seconds are going to be
one of us a manager. One of us a manager right now in the Premier League.
Oh, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
There you go.
Oh, yeah. He's gifted at me on a plate, man. We can stop the clock there. There's no way I'm going to get any more.
No, I think you flapped it there. I think you could, if you would have thought about it logically. If you delved back into that footballing knowledge you have in the 90s, you would have got some of these. Listen to this. Torre André Flo, number 3.
You know, I didn't even know he was Norwegian.
23 goals. Stefan Iversen, 21 goals.
What Tottenham. When I got that.
Jan Fjortoff, I think he played for... Did he play for Blackburn? 20 goals. Øyvind Leonardsen, another player that played in the Premier League, 19 goals. Joshua King, currently playing for Watford, 17 goals. And obviously, you've got Morten Gamst Pedersen that you got. So, fair play. You got a point out of that. Moves you on to 3 points. Jan Arne Riise, just outside the top 10.
Mate, I seen him on a plane coming back from Norway.
You wouldn't have got him. Obviously, you wouldn't have got him. He was just out of the top 10. I feel like there's a few there that potentially you could have got. There's a guy called Kjetil Rekdal I've never heard of. There's a guy called Odd Iversen. God knows
mate,
who he is.
I've got to applaud you, Bissett. Those are some good questions, man. The right level of difficulty. Fair play.
That's what I was trying to do. Didn't want to make them too difficult, but I also wanted to open it up so you had a chance of getting them. So 3 points, that's what I'm going to have to beat next week.
That were generous, though. I should really have two and a half. You gave me that last one. But so, yeah, fair play. I'm a bit gutted I didn't get the Holyfield Bow one, but...
All right, so we haven't really got a massive combat sports review this week, have we? We'll reel that off, and then we're good to go. All right, so off you go.
So there were a few carnival fights last weekend, as we've been getting used to in the past couple of months. Thankfully, both of them ended in first round knockouts, with Anderson Silva beating Tito Ortiz and Vitor Belfort, as you alluded to earlier, beating Evander Holyfield, who's just about to turn 59 years old. The formula of pageantry plus name value continues to reap enough profit so that middle-aged fighters are able to get decent paydays despite their clearly diminishing skills. I've read some of the reactions and people seem most upset by the Holyfield fight, labelling his performance as sad. And I can see why. He did fall over trying to throw a left hook. But your man was going life and death with Dwight Muhammad Cowie 5 years before I was born, man. Do you know what I mean? Put that in your head and just let it sink in. Well, I was learning to read and write. He was trading wins with Riddick Bowe, one of them in 1994, as you said. So three. What the... fuck's sake. 1993. This is what I'm saying. Like, these are generations ago. What do people expect? But I'll tell you what, Anderson Silva, who's 45 or something, he could have definitely been an amazing boxer if he didn't stick to MMA. And he's considered one of the best MMA competitors of all time.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd say that sad is the best way to describe that. I think it's quite sad, the fact that a 59-year-old ex-boxer feels the need that to earn a bit of extra money, he has to go. I feel like he has to go. He's not forced into it. But the opportunities are so lucrative now by these events that like Triller are sort of like conjuring up. They seem to be like the sort of like boxing meme company. Do you know what I mean? Putting on these stupid fights. But the fact that he's 59, he feels like he has to go out and make a bit of money. I don't know whether he's doing it purely for financial reasons, but I can't really understand why else he'd be doing it. Why else would he put himself through that?
I think he's got about 5 or 6 ex-wives, all of them. And he doesn't like get prenuptial agreements.
You think he'd learn from the first one, wouldn't you? You know what I mean?
You'd think so. Yeah. He's got about 15 kids. It's reported that he's amassed well over $200 million in his career.
And spunked
a lot. So, and also he's pretty much known as a fiercely competitive guy, but you can't stop the clock. Your man's nearly 60. They called it an exhibition, but it wasn't that.
He's a granddad in the ring. Like, there should be limits on this, because I think, and there's also a threat to somebody's life, I think, when they get to that age.
Listen,
and
they're fighting absolutely.
The ring. He's already gone through, like, you know, if he was, you know, Holyfield, like, known as one of these boxers that can take a punch, getting back off the canvas and going on and, like, winning fights and sort of, like, you know, going to the edge and showing that extra bit of wind. Like, he's already had that damage to the brain. And we talk about CTE quite a lot on this podcast. So, you know, it's a real threat to his livelihood if he's getting in the ring at 60. It's just outright dangerous, mate.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would compel anyone who's got any interest in boxing to go and watch an Evander Holyfield highlight reel, because when that man was in his prime, he was the epitome of a warrior. It's the same old cliche And it just keeps recycling and recycling and recycling. These boys will fight any day of the week. And if they haven't got people around them with their best interests at heart, they're going to be exploited. And that's just what happened to Holyfield the other day. He was supposed to be Oscar De La Hoya in there fighting Vitor Belfort. He got COVID, allegedly. He's probably on the sniff. Yeah, and he got dragged in. He's willing to fight. And he just got chinned in the first round. I'm glad the referee stepped in there, man, because for once... Not for once, that's a bit unfair. It's just good to see a referee safeguarding a fighter. But that kind of brings me on, in terms of criticising the officials, that brings me on to the real tragedy of last week. And it revolved around the WBC super featherweight champion, Oscar Valdez. Now, this man tested positive for fentanyl and was still allowed to defend his title against Robson Conceição. Now, Victor Conte, who's a scientist, former distributor of PEDs himself, went to prison for his involvement in the Balco scandal in the early 2000s involving Shane Mosley and a host of other athletes, including a sprinter from the UK, one of them who went to go play American football in Germany, Dwayne Chambers. So he was the man, he's involved in PEDs and also the basis for Tower of Power back in the 70s. But I found a little snippet of what he said about the substance that was found in Valdez's samples. Fentanyl is from the amphetamine family. So most have heard of methamphetamine, and it's from that same group of drugs. It's a potent, powerful stimulant. It raises the heart rate. It increases oxygen delivery to muscle tissue. It makes you stronger. It makes you faster. It increases your training time to exhaustion. So it's absolutely, positively a performance-enhancing drug. I'm just baffled that the WBC president, Suleiman, is saying it's not a PED, when we will go through some of the history here, not only proving it's a PED, but a dangerous PED that athletes have died from using during competition. So I've spoke in the past about how I feel that performance-enhancing drugs are just a natural extension of a training regime to stay fit, to recover, to make yourself stronger, to make yourself faster, to make yourself have more endurance. I don't really have a problem with him using fentanyl. What I do have a problem with is this facade of everyone saying, oh, PEDs are bad, oh, you shouldn't use that. The WBC have a clean boxers program. Do you know what I mean? It's a mandatory thing if you want to get sanctioned by the WBC. This guy's A and B sample nearly melted through the fucking jar and they let him fight anyway. And then think about this. They let the fight go ahead. Then the judges and certainly the referee conspired to rob the challenger, can't say so, of a deserved victory. I had him the clear winner, 116-111. The referee clearly favoured Valdez in his handling of the fight. He deducted a point from Conceição in the ninth round for hitting behind the head, which was a laughable infraction when you see it. And even more so when you see that Valdez was doing the same thing more often and with more force, but suffered no penalties whatsoever. Two judges scored the fight to Valdez, 115-112, which I disagree with, but I wouldn't be going on about. But I reckon Judge Stephen Blay dropped acid before he watched the fight because he must have been in another dimension to score it 117-110 to Valdez. Absolutely outrageous, man. I
was disgraced by this, to be honest. Reading through it, I briefly sort of like read something on social media about it, but I didn't really see, you know, how bad this had got and realized that that it went this far and sort of like there's just so many things that really epitomizes the sort of like Wild West attitude that some of these boxing boards have. And I cannot believe, like, you know, we've got sort of like contrasting stances on PEDs. Like, I just think they should just not be allowed. There should be nothing that you can inject into your body or take into your body that should improve your ability to basically beat an opponent. And especially in a sport where you're using your fists, where basically you've got weapons and you're trying to destroy another fighter, absolutely should be zero tolerance. And I cannot believe that this has been allowed to happen. It's so hypocritical, isn't it? Like, it's so hypocritical they've got this regime to try and get, you know, a clean policy regime or whatever. And then they're allowing him to continue when they know for a fact he's got methamphetamine inside his body, man. Like, you know what I mean? You know what this drug does to people. Do you know what I mean? And they know for a fact that he's gaining a huge advantage. And the geezer still boxed his head off. And then for him to turn around and the judges to say that he only won 3 of the 12 rounds, that is an absolute disgrace. Because even ESPN, they said that they gave the fight, I think, 114 to 113, would it be?
115, 113 to Valdez.
Yeah.
Look, I hold my hands up. There are a couple of rounds in that fight that could have gone either way, which could have handed Valdez the fight on a close decision. I've got no real problem with that. But that 117, 110 can fuck right off, man. I was shouting at my telly the other day, man. I was actually outraged to the point where I was thinking, I'm not sure if I'm really down with this anymore, man. I can't... What the double standards of it...
It's just disillusioning, really pisses, man. And yeah. Coming from you, who's a massive, massive boxing fan, it makes me angry. So I can't imagine what true boxing fans... I say true in the respect that they put a lot of effort into following fighters, you know, and they watch a lot of the sort of like... underground cards and the lesser known boxers, whereas, you know, someone like me, I would class myself as a casual fan. I'll watch the big fights. I wouldn't really necessarily go and watch these sort of fights that I wouldn't really know about them for a start. And it's not just this guy that feels sorry for, it's boxing fans. The fact that they've had to go through and watch is absolute charade, man, because that's what it is. And it's disgusting. And sport, we've said, man, we don't agree on PEDs, but we agree that sport should be competitive. Yes. Sports should be fair. There should be a level playing field for both fighters, especially when you're in such a sport where there's a danger to someone's health. And this is in the same category as a sort of like Evander Holyfield thing, even though this is a lot more egregious. But the fact is that fighters need to be protected. And the fact that they've allowed a guy that's drugged up to get in a ring with him, and they know for a fact that people have died after people have been known to be on performance enhancing drugs. Honestly, I cannot be more sort of disgusted by this. I can't, really, really can't.
I am disillusioned by it. That's all the business side of it, and it's all the politicking and the image and the pay-per-views and these fucking fake world championships that apparently mean so much, but when it comes down to it, it doesn't mean anything, because they can just change reality however they want. Something that was absolutely pure in terms of competition, which is the fight that I watched last night, I eventually caught up in it, was Sam Eggington versus Belil Jaquita. I'm telling you, man, that was one of the most... And this sounds horrible as well. If I'm so worried about a fight as well being, I shouldn't really be into a fight that was this violent. This was had a minor belt on the line. There was about 500 people in the crowd. I can't remember seeing a fight contested so earnestly. Two men who wanted to win so much. Sam Eggington, like, he's from Stourbridge, just down the road from Brum. He started off boxing. He wanted to be a journeyman. You can't have lower aspirations than that to get into boxing. Found out he had a bit of talent. Got loads of headway on Slimy Eddie's Matchroom cards. And now he's just having a steady progression at European level. And this Belil Jaquita was undefeated in 15. Big reputation coming out of France. And they beat the living shit out of each other. I should not have watched that fight before bed. Do you know what I mean? I was so excited.
The adrenaline in your body after watching it was just like coursing through your veins.
No, I'm telling you, man. And it was just after the whole Valdez thing, that reminded me why I love boxing so much. Even though I wouldn't be surprised if Eggington is blowing bubbles by the time he's 50, because you can't take that kind of fucking punishment, man. It's like, it is a double standard on my part, because... On one hand, I respect the boxers and I respect the effort they put in. And on the other hand, I celebrate the punishment they put themselves through. And it's conflicting at times, to be honest with you. And it might be some of that creeping in. So why I'm pulling away from boxing a little bit and MMA a little bit. I still watch it a lot and I still relish in what's going on. But I do feel a bit guilty about watching it all, because I know this is having long-term effects. There's no way you can take punishment like them two lads took last weekend and be... the same person afterwards.
Yeah. I mean, I personally think there's going to be some kind of, or there has to be a point where there's kind of an independent governing body or adjudicator or a panel or something that can sort of try and manage what's going on in boxing, because there seems to be so many of these instances and so many situations where shit like this keeps happening. And I just feel like it is like the Wild West, isn't it, man? People are just doing whatever they want. Like, there's money being thrown about everywhere. Triller, like, honestly, you know, organizing these sort of Triller, like circus fights.
They're a music label. They have
50
no...
Cent, 50 Cent and Sean Porter on like commentary for that Evander Holyfield fight on that
but
card.
But even then, you think that
Snoop Dogg and all that.
Long-standing promoters like Matchroom, Top Rank,
well, you know, Top Rank,
PBC.
How on earth can they try and hold up like any of their reputation after they've like allowed that fight to go on. And obviously they've got a decision. They had some kind of culpability, really, because they could have called that fight off. They could have said, we don't agree with this. This guy's on PEDs. He could potentially kill this person because it's making him faster, stronger. And like, you know, he can take more of a punch. He's going to be out of his mind. Like, we don't want this fight. Call it off. They had the ability to do that.
You don't need the sanctioning bodies to make a fight happen. You need the state athletic commission or the local governing body to sanction the fight. That's all you need. The only reason promoters are involved is to get fans there, obviously, so you can make money and fighters can earn a living. But the only reason that belts mean anything nowadays, they used to mean something. But the only reason they mean anything nowadays is because that's how you sell a fight on TV. That's the only thing. It's commercialization. That's all it is. It's, again, that the tentacles creeping into every aspect of our lives, man. And here, it could have had tragic consequences.
Of course it could
have. I'm glad it didn't. So grateful that it didn't. But, you know, it's just, it's a disheartening thing. And again, I could chew your ear off all night about it, man. But let me, I'll move on to what's going on this weekend because it's a bit of a quiet one and then we can wrap it up. There's nothing going on with the boxing this weekend, as far as I'm aware. We're waiting for October 9th, Fury and Wilder 3. A lot of people are speculating that's not going ahead for whatever reason. I don't know. And there's nothing from the MMA world, really, to review from last week. But from this week, again, a bit of a stopgap week before UFC 266. Yoel Romero makes his Bellator debut against Phil Davis. Anthony Smith and Ryan Spann headline the UFC Apex card on Sunday. And that's about it, man. Again, we're waiting for Fury Wilder 3. We're waiting for Joshua versus Usyk on the 25th or the 26th. So that's next weekend. And again, the MMA world is going to have all their eyes on UFC 266. Massive card headlined by Alexander Volkanovski versus Brian Ortega for the featherweight title. There's also...
And then in November, we've got Canelo Plant. And then we've got that huge card with Zhang Weili and Rose Namajunas, the rematch. Then you've got Covington who's he fighting? Usman. Covington?
Yeah. There's a lot to look forward to, man. But yeah, again, I'm sorry to end it on such a fucking sobering note, really. But yeah.
That's what it is. That's the way sports goes, isn't it? And sometimes you talk about sports and boxing is one of those, it's one of those sports that really can divide opinions. And make you feel conflicted in the way you sort of view it. You know what I mean? You don't want to completely get engulfed in that sort of like primitive nature that we have of watching two blokes scrap in the ring and like basically, you know, try and rip each other apart. Because that's what it would have been in the sort of like, you know, in the Colosseum, you know, back in the Roman times. It's just sort of like, it's an evolution of that at the end of the day. And it like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a sort of like a constant chip away. All right, what can we make a little bit more safer? But do you think there's going to be things that are going to make the sport safe in the future? Who knows, man? Because you're going to take a lot away from the sport, aren't you, at the same time? So it's a huge conversation for another day, isn't it?
We'll keep chipping away at it, man. But I look forward to next week and look forward to trying to find the right balance with your quiz questions. And I'm going to look at the Atlanta Falcons. I'm going to try and cobble together some kind of opinion on where they're going and what they're doing and all that kind of stuff. I'm looking forward to next week, man.
Yeah, so we're going to have loads more football to talk about next week. Obviously, we've got the Ryder Cup coming up that I think starts on Tuesday. So that'll be a good watch. That obviously only comes around every couple of years. USA versus America. They're the same fucking people, aren't they? Europe versus USA, rather. So yeah, that'll be pretty interesting. We'll probably have a little review on that. Maybe have a smaller review on the week too. I don't know if we're going to do a week by week NFL review, but if there's any sort of like big things that pop up, we can have a little chat about it. But that's about it. That wraps it up for this week's episode. Make sure you check us out on all the socials. Flynn, he's managed to become our PR manager in a way, so I'm absolutely loving it at the minute. He's trying to get in contact with Paddy the Baddy Pimlet, isn't he? We're trying to get Jim to go down to Liverpool on his podcast tomorrow. So let's hope he responds, man, because you better ship off, man. I'll pay for your tickets. Go down there, get on his podcast. Big up, wax lyrical about the bull chat.
If that's happening, yeah, tomorrow is my only day off work. And if that lines up, I'm going, man.
I'm telling you, man. Let's hope he gets back to us, man, because that would be absolutely amazing, man. And he seems the sort of guy that would just do shit like that, don't he? He looks like he does not give a fuck about anything, man. He'll just do anything. Definitely. So yeah, that would be that'd be absolutely hilarious. And you know, fair play to him as well, man. Like, he's killing it lately. Do you know what I mean? Old Paddy.
If he does it, fingers crossed for tomorrow, man.
All right, Wicked Jim, nice to see you again as always. Even though it's been a bit of a long one, 2 weeks off, but glad to be back into the swing of things. And I'll see you next week.
It's a pleasure, son, as always.